I am Platt on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. A fascinating new book looks at the food supply in the world and how we can feed what's estimated soon to be 9 billion people living on this planet. It's called Feeding Frenzy, Land Grabs, Price Spikes, and the World Food Crisis. As the subtitle suggests, the book looks at the reasons why the supply of food is so unstable and how governments and business are reacting in preparation or in response to the food economy. The book's author, Paul McMahon, joins me now. I'll ask him about why, at the turn of the 21st century, we have a billion people overweight and another billion malnourished. We'll reflect on the dangers to come and what countries are doing in response or in reaction. As well, we'll look at ways we can feed the world. In recent days, we've seen stories as to the rising of beef prices, not to mention other food. So is that the reality? Higher prices? Paul McMahon recently co-founded SLM Partners, a business that is investing more than $100 million in grass-fed ranching in Australia, and he's a consultant for nonprofits and government. He has a PhD in history from Cambridge, and soon after receiving that, was part of the consulting firm McKinsey & Company in New York. He served as an advisor to the Prince of Wales's International Sustainability Unit and to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization in Rome. Feeding Frenzy was published last year in the United Kingdom and the United States and is now published in Canada by Greystone. He joined me from London, England. Please welcome to the Platt Online program, Paul McMahon. Dr. McMahon, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. I guess it's evening where you are, is that right?
Yeah, early evening. It's a beautiful spring day here in London.
Yeah. So if it weren't true, it'd be hard to believe. But we have a billion people on this planet who are overweight, and we have another billion, or close to a billion, who are malnourished. What accounts for this disparity?
Well, you've hit on the greatest paradox in the global food system at the moment, and one of the greatest challenges. Like everything in the world, there's no easy answer. It's a combination of different factors. You know, on the one hand, this is the most serious problem of 1 billion people being malnourished. In developing countries, it's to do with a set of things. It's to do with a lack of agricultural technology. It's to do with bad trade policies. It's to do with bad governance and political systems in some of these countries. And in some cases, to do with natural resource constraints. Whether it's water or soils or the availability of land. So a whole range of things come together, which means that some parts of the world are chronically poor and struggle to produce enough food. But I think the fundamental problem behind it all is poverty, and so it is the poor people in the world who tend to go hungry. And then on the other hand, in the richer countries, but also as is amongst the middle classes of the developing world now as well, you have rising rates of obesity, people who are overweight, and all the diseases associated with that, and that's also got a set of factors behind it, to do with diet, to do with sedentary lifestyle, but I think it also has to do with the fact that we're often promoted unhealthy foods, and people eat probably too much of the wrong things, and that's backed by a marketing juggernaut in a way, which encourages people to do that.
So it's not a question of us in the West eating all the food up and leaving those in developing countries hungry. Is it that, or is it perhaps the fact that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer? I mean, does that feed into the food crisis?
Yeah, well, I think it's a bit simplistic to say that the people in the West are eating eating the lunch of poor countries, and I know you see that being talked about quite a bit, but yeah. it really isn't that simple. Actually, the rich countries, so you take North America, the U.S. and Canada, actually produce great surpluses of food and actually export quite a bit to the world markets. The problem is that in the poorest countries of the world, people are actually too poor to afford that. They can't afford to go out and compete in the world market. And neither should they in many cases. A lot of the countries where people are hungry today and poor are those where they have the potential to produce an awful lot more food themselves. And I think those countries, the way to tackle their problems is for them to produce more, because the examples we have around the world of countries that have gone up the development curve, which have tackled rural poverty, which have reduce malnutrition, they've done it by investing in agricultural sectors, by creating jobs, creating livelihoods for people in the rural economy, and that can act as a real strong, virtuous engine for growth throughout those countries. I'm thinking, for example, of somewhere like Vietnam, which made great progress in the 1980s, the last 30 years, reducing poverty, and they did that by investing in the farmers, increasing production, and as opposed to going cap in hand to the world markets.
And when we hear Kofi Annan say that Africa can feed itself in the world, is that much the same way?
Yeah, if you look at the science around Africa as a continent, and the amount of fertile land, water resources, the ecological potential, the biophysical potential, Africa, in theory, could produce all the food it needs and even produce more food for export. So, in theory, it could be the bread basket for the world. Alongside South America, it probably has the biggest reserve of arable land, which has not been exploited at the moment. Getting to that theoretical endpoint, of course, isn't so easy, and it does require a lot of changes and investment in infrastructure and new policies and supporting small farmers and helping them grow through sustainable farming systems. So it's not necessarily easy, but certainly the potential is there.
So why is it happening in Africa? I mean, is that the sort of political structure, the governments that they have there, or is it us in the West preventing that, perhaps?
I think it's a mixture. I think, for sure, the Western trade policy has not always been helpful to the developing countries of Africa, in that this is the Washington Consensus, and the well-paid economists in the West have been encouraging these countries to take down their tariffs and trade barriers and to open themselves up to free trade and food as much as possible. And what's happened as a result is local farmers do find it very hard to compete. The richer urban population tend to rely more on imported foods, and then it's the poor rural populations who are kind of a bit left in the middle and don't have access to enough. And I think that's been a pretty poor outcome for a lot of African countries. So I think rectifying that requires probably cleverer trade policies by those African countries. I think in some cases, tariffs and let's say a managed interface with the world market makes sense, but it also requires investing a lot in local farmers, in particular smallholders, and that's with skills and training and equipment and infrastructure and really good governance and good government, and that's not always easy to come by. Having said that, there are examples in Africa of countries which have been able to increase production a lot. If you look at Malawi has done over the past few years, where it has been able to increase its maize production, I think it tripled over the past 10 years, and they've done that with heavy government support for local agriculture, so it can be done.
Now, food costs have been going up in North America. I'm sure they're the same in Europe and in Britain. What's the reason for that, and do you think high food prices are here to stay, and then that we should get used to that, what we're paying now, and perhaps more down the line?
Yeah, and that's one of the main motivations for me writing the book, because I think we've all noticed when we go to the supermarkets that there's a little bit less change in our pocket when we come out. And lying behind that has been a big rise in the prices of the raw commodities, whether it's wheat or rice or maize or beef or pork or chicken, olive oil, you name it. There's been a big rise in the price of the commodities the last 5-6 years. If you look at the UN food index, it reached its highest level ever, I think in 2012. And there have been a few dips and ups and downs, but overall, the prices are now at a much higher structural level than they have been for the past 20, 30 years, when we had this sort of an era of incredibly cheap food. Will it continue? I actually think it will. I think there's a number of reasons why food prices are high now. If you look at just this relentless march of demand that's coming out of developing countries and different Asia as people get richer and want richer diets and more protein-heavy diets, that just continues to roll on. We have bioenergy as a new factor, which has played a big role in propping up maize prices and corn prices in the U.S. in particular. And then on the supply side, you know, there are farming systems, industrial farming systems in particular, they are hitting up against ecological limits in some parts of the world, you know, where there are areas where aquifers are drying up, where land is being degraded, and we're seeing yield increases plateau. And then probably on top of everything, we're seeing extreme climate events. You know, we're seeing droughts in California, floods in Thailand or parts of Australia. And these events are coming more frequently now with more intensity. And I think all the science is indicating that's because of climate change, and that is only going to get worse. So I think if you kind of put all these factors together, I think, you know, we do see a pretty tight situation in food markets, and that's not likely to go away anytime soon.
So there's urgency with regards to climate change. I mean, that's, you just mentioned California. Is that where it's most keenly felt? You're seeing farmland there it's drying up literally, isn't it?
Yeah, and we're seeing, you know, competition for water breaking out in a serious way between urban users, between the cities, between industrial users, or power plants, and then the farmers. You know, and I think farmers are finding out they're often at the end of the pipe when it comes to getting allocation of scarce water supplies, and because of that, some of them are being forced to really scale back on production this year, and that's why we're seeing increases in vegetable prices and nut prices, because California is such a huge producer of fruit, vegetables, nuts, and other products for the North American market. And I think this is a bit of a canary in the coal mine when it comes to climate change. I think we're going to see more of this, and so, you know, we're living in a more volatile world, and we all have to really think carefully how we can make our food systems more resilient to these kinds of wild weather events.
Now, do you think there's a will to tackle climate change? I mean, there's great disparity in terms of how people feel on it. I mean, there's still some debate in this country, in the United States especially, whether it exists or whether it's real.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've spent a lot of time living in the U.S. and just to compare attitudes there with, for example, in Europe, where I think it's become a sort of commonplace assumption or understanding that climate change is real and it's man-made and it's something we have to take seriously, whereas I think in North America it probably is still a matter more for debate and has even become almost a bit of a taboo subject, I think, in certain circles because it stirs up such a furious reaction. But I think even in Europe, where it may be a commonplace that it exists, there still isn't much of a will to do very much about it. And I think if you look over the progress of the UN conventions and this is the more grand international processes over the last 5-10 years, they haven't achieved a whole lot. And I think we're kind of locked onto a path now where we'll have warming of probably at least 2 degrees of this century, probably more. So I think to some extent, some of these changes are going to happen no matter what we do. Just it's a question now of how intense those changes get, and that still does come down to political will and economic will on behalf of the people and the nations of the world. So, but no, I think we'll have to wait a little bit longer until we see some real changes to the structures of our economies.
Now, an unstable food supply, we're told, if it gets volatile enough, we will see the breakout of wars and the sort. Where do you think that happens? I mean, if it does happen first, I mean, where would that be, and is it war really that we would see manifest itself?
Yeah, well, I think you've touched on an important point here, in that that the world does have enough land and water and resources to feed everyone. You know, in fact, we could feed 10 billion people today. You know, but we end up feeding an awful lot of grains to animals, and then we waste probably 30% of all the food that's produced. So it's not really an issue of production. It's one of distribution, of access, affordability, and wealth and power. And I think if you play forward some of these trends we've been discussing, we're going to see those factories come into play even more intensely. And I think that in the next few decades that the geopolitics of food is going to become a very important issue. Will it lead to war? I don't know. I mean, there are certainly flashpoints, whether that's over, you know, water and the flow of the Nile from an effort to, for example, build dams upstream and in certain countries, which Egypt is very upset about and has threatened to take action necessary. Or I think, you know, you could just see a greater fragmentation of food markets, one where the richer, stronger countries are able to gain control of supply chains and in a way to cure their needs. And it's the poor developing countries which become more and more vulnerable, you know, to these extreme events and to food price spikes and in a way, you know, just spiral as much into perhaps internal conflict as opposed to, you know, wars across borders. In terms of where I think the regions are that are most at risk, you know, if you plot population growth against availability of arable land and ecological constraints, I mean, there's a big swathe of South Asia, you know, which really jumps out. And, you know, talking about India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Sri Lanka, and those regions of the world are set to grow from about 1.6 billion people to 2.4 billion people in the next 40 years. And they already have some of the, you know, the lowest availability of land per person, and that's just going to get, that area is going to get smaller, and there are already issues with water and other, you know, ecological and environmental problems. So, you know, I think there certainly are parts of the world where you see all these trends coming together in a fairly threatening way, and it will depend on you know, how those governments respond and also how the world responds if we're able to collaborate and cooperate and make sure that food is available equally to everyone.
Well, what's an example, Dr. McMahon, of where we see governments and corporations at cross purposes in terms of securing control over the food supply and its distribution? I mean, are we seeing that today?
Yeah, the last 5-6 years, you know, since we had food prices spike in 2008, has in a way unleashed a frenzy in a way of efforts to control supply chains and to control markets in a way and particular food trade. I'd point to two examples. So on the one hand, you know, when prices have risen over the past few years, we've seen a number of countries take steps to control exports and to try and restrict food exports. And I think 2008, 2009, about 33 different countries in the world imposed some kind of import export restrictions. And the idea behind that is to you know, slow the flow of food out of the country so that domestic prices are kept down. And it is, you may have heard in economics the term beggar thy neighbor policy. This is can be a starve thy neighbor policy in that it can perhaps work to the advantage of the country taking those steps, but it tends to have very damaging effects on world markets and can lead to shortages. And we saw it in the rice market in 2008-2009, where a number of countries hoarded rice and prices tripled in about 6 months. Another example that, in a completely new phenomenon that we're seeing is efforts by countries and by corporations that often, you know, subtly supported or encouraged by their national government to acquire farmland abroad, in particular in some of the poorest countries of the world, so what's been called land grabs. And that's certainly a new phenomenon that we haven't really seen on this scale probably since the 19th century. And we're seeing powerful actors from Asia, the Middle East, but also from North America and Europe, you know, looking to acquire large tracts of land for staple food production. And you know, that investment, if done well, can have some positive benefits, but if not, it can lead to people being cleared off their land. It can lead to food being being secured for export and not being available for local markets. So that's, again, a very new and potentially worrying trend in some of the poorest countries in the world.
So you're seeing that in Asia, in Africa?
We're seeing Africa is probably the crucible. I think a lot of the trends we talk about so far, but also for this wave of land grabs. And I think there was a study done a couple of years back, and they counted up all the deals that had been announced for farmland in Africa, and the total size was the same size as the country of Tunisia. So So there's some very big deals being talked about. Now, a lot of that has been more probably rumor than action, and more media reports than actual shovels being applied to ground. I think a lot of people, when they've signed agreements and wanted to do things, but then actually found in practice it's very hard to make progress. But having said that, there are some projects there in places, Ethiopia, Sudan, and elsewhere, which are trying to carve out big pieces of land and bring in big machinery, industrial agriculture, and looking to grow food primarily for export. And that's something that we're still seeing happening on the ground.
Well, what's happening with China? Because China has always had the reputation of feeding itself. There was something that I read recently where they took over a pork-producing company in the United States, in Virginia, I believe?
Yeah, Smithfield, the biggest pork producer in the world. China's a fascinating one thing happening over the last 10 years or so, in that the Chinese government always had a policy of being self-sufficient. And actually, they achieved that. And China, the story of Chinese agriculture from the 1970s onwards is actually a great success story after the sort of tragedies and disaster of Mao's reforms earlier in the century. China was able to really increase production, ramp up food production, and generally feed its population, and was even an exporter of food up until sort of mid-2000s. But that's also had a change as the incomes have risen and people have changed their diets and are demanding more of everything, but in particular more meat. The massive Chinese population and limited land areas, China is no longer able to feed itself, and it's become a big buyer of raw commodities in world markets. It now imports about, I think, almost 50 million tons of soybeans, which is mostly from South America, which is really a massive amount, and it's starting to import corn from the U.S. and really sucking in product from all around the world. China often has been blamed for land grabs, for trying to buy up Africa and different parts of the world. Actually, in my book, when I did the research, I found that's actually a bit of a myth. Certainly when it comes to Africa, China has probably done more good than bad in terms of trying to support local research, local institutions trying to work with existing farmers, and hasn't actually been buying up large amounts of land. But on the other hand, it is only a very active when it comes to mergers and acquisitions of large agribusinesses. The Smithfield example is the biggest so far. It's the biggest Chinese acquisition of any American company. But this year they've also announced plans to buy up Nidera, which is a European grain trading firm, taking a big stake in Noble, which is a Singapore-based food trade company. And so I think that the policy that they have, it seems, is to really try and get control of supply chains, to get control of silos and ships and the infrastructure of food trade, so that I think, partly for economic reasons, so they get more of the value along the supply chain, but partly for security reasons. So I think if there ever was a crisis, then they will control the sources of supply more directly.
Now, this book was published about a year ago in Britain, I understand, and it's now being published here in Canada. Have you noticed in the course of the year that the book's been out, essentially, that there have been changes? And I'm curious to know what they are. Or the trends that you saw, that the trends that you articulate in the book, are they continuing?
Well, thankfully, anyway, the book hasn't been proved to be completely wrong yet, in that we did see a bit of a dip in food prices probably towards the end of last year. We had a bumper North American corn harvest, and that put some downward pressure on pricing. But that's all going to bounce back again this year, as we've seen drought in California and the southern states of the U.S. We see what's happening in Russia, Ukraine, putting pressure on wheat prices, meat prices, for example, beef cattle prices reach all-time highs in the U.S. in February this year. So actually, we've had a real rebound, and prices are still at a very elevated level. So I think that remains to be true. I think also we've seen probably more steps, in particular from Chinese interest to make these acquisitions along the food supply chain. So a number of these deals have just been announced in the past 12 months. And when it comes to some of the science around this stuff, one of the developments has been the release of various reports from the International Panel on Climate Change, you know, who've been completing their latest assessment on that, the last one 7 years ago, and that's starting to pull together evidence showing, again, that, you know, these trends around a warming climate, a more volatile climate, are intensifying and are here to stay. So, you know, it is gratifying that most of the things in the book just are continuing on as before. In terms of things which have maybe turned for the better, I think one good thing we've seen probably over the last couple of years is that I think governments are more aware maybe of the risks of putting in place those export bans I was talking about before, and of trying to manipulate trade in ways that can be very damaging to the rest of the world. So that, I think there has been concerted effort by international policymakers to draw attention to that and to really put pressure on countries not to, you know, take a knee-jerk reaction and slap bans on food when prices jump a bit, to try and work together and try and sort of calm down the market. So maybe we are making a little bit of progress on that front.
And in this trend, 30, 40 years from now, there'll be 9 billion people on this planet. You don't see that changing?
No, I think one thing about population growth, a lot of it is baked in, you know, based on the number of people of different ages in the world today. You can make pretty good assumptions of how many people will be around in 40, 50 years. Now, of course, there are some variables around fertility rates, and that can change as countries get richer in particular. But I think, you know, we know there'll be about 9 to 10 billion people on the planet in 2050. But I think that, you know, the number itself, it sounds large. You know, we're going from 7 to, let's say, 9.5 billion in 40 years. But actually, if you look what happened from the 1950s and 60s, you know, the population increased even quicker then. And we were able to double or triple food production in that period. So, you know, it can be done. And as I mentioned before, you know, the science shows that we do have enough land and water, enough resources at a global level. And that actually even now we could feed 9 to 10 million people. But the problem is that so much food is wasted and people are too poor to afford it. So it really isn't a Malthusian problem. It's much more of a socioeconomic and sustainability problem, which we do have the technologies and tools to fix if we have the political will and the foresight to take action.
This is such a fascinating book and a highly readable one at that. It gives us a lot to think about. Thanks for your time today, Dr. McMahon, and continued good luck with the book.
Okay, thanks very much. Enjoy talking to you.
The book is called Feeding Frenzy, Land Grabs, Price Spikes, and the World Food Crisis. It's published by Greystone. Its author, Dr. Paul McMahon, joined me on the line from London, England, in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plutton.